So I tweeted out a picture of the racist corn box,
the offensive corn pop, the
racist cereal box.
If you go to TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and the Justice and Drew page, along with Sam, you can see it there for yourself, or you can see it up on Twitter. There was a guy, Marvel Comics, creates his own comic, saw this on a box, and it was, why is the one not so yellow corn pop character on the box waxing the floors?
Right. Well, my question would be, why is there one corn pop on the box that looks different? Because every other corn pop on the box is the exact same color. So somebody along the line decided, hey, this one should be a slightly different hue.
Well, it's clear that artwork's pretty old. I'd like to know the history. Yeah. That artwork's been around for... I mean, I understand there are still some arcades, but the general idea that there are kids going... Because I, as a kid, used to go to the arcade.
There aren't arcades in malls anymore.
Right, like where you would just go to play video games, because now we have, you know, there's Xboxes and PlayStations and whatnot.
That was the only reason I would ever go to a mall when I was young, go to the arcade.
No, pick up on girls. That was the real reason to go to the mall.
Yeah, I wasn't good at that.
Yeah, no, I wasn't either.
I was just in the arcade.
Yeah, I just did the stare. Hope they stared back.
Mike, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Go ahead. You got a comment on the racist cereal box?
Yes. One on that and another comment. First of all, what's wrong with being a janitor?
Right?
True.
When I saw it, that was the first thing that popped into my head.
Nothing. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a dignified job just like every other job.
And my other comment about the data that came out with the income disparities, I didn't see the report, but are they comparing apples to apples as far as a white person that's gone to college and a black person that's gone to college and a white person that has a high school diploma versus a black person that has a high school diploma?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't dug into the report to know if they've exerted those types of controls on this information.
Well, I think if you compare apples to apples, a lot of times the data will shift and things maybe aren't as bad as...
You're right. And it speaks to, again, the root cause, the bottom line of all this. It goes back to the public education system. The public education system in Minneapolis and in St. Paul and in the Twin Cities area in Hennepin County, it is absolutely failing minority students. It is doing irreparable and generational damage, and it has for a long time, to minority students. So anybody that wants to make that their central focus and their central issue, and I have no problem with that, you know, being their central focus and being their number one issue, they should be working to reform the schools.
Right.
Because that's where those changes are going to take place. That's where they're going to have the most impact. But we can't talk about substantive school reform. We can't talk about giving parents the opportunity to pull their kids out of a failing public school and send them to a school of their choice, because the teachers union has an iron fist grip on all things education in the state, and they are the primary motivating factor and primary driving force behind most of the DFL policies when it comes to education.
And that's not agenda driven. It's not going to get any of these individuals who are running for the mayoral race in Minneapolis the attention that they need if they want to go in and win this election.
Right. Yeah, the Urban League? Was that what it was?
Yeah, Minneapolis Urban League.
Yeah, they're absolutely right that this is an electoral strategy and nothing more.
From Intellectual Takeout, in the Guthrie Theater, happening October 30th, Is There a War Against Men? A Controversial Conversation will feature one Christina Hoff Summers, and she joins us on the phone right now. Very pleased to welcome. Thanks for coming on the show this morning. We greatly appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So for those that might be interested in attending this event, it's happening on Monday night, October 30th. At the Guthrie, as we mentioned, and I'll tweet out a link for ticket details here using the hashtag TCNT shortly. What can they look forward to? What can they expect?
Well, I am, I consider myself a feminist, but I'm concerned that the women's movement has gone over the edge and into male bashing, ignoring the problems of boys, and treating taking positions that are so extreme that it's sort of ruining the movement. So how do we get feminism back on track, and will it be possible now that the movement has become so carried away with anger politics, identity politics, calling people out, being triggered, especially on campus.
Is there anything, I mean, well, what can you attribute to this? Is this a concerted effort to get away from what real feminism is in this war on men, or is this something that's sort of, I don't want to say naturally happened over time, but what can you attribute to this?
Oh, no, it was quite intentional from scholars in the university who base their feminism not on classical liberal principles, but on radical principles. The women's movement in the university is very carried away with condemning America as an oppressive patriarchy. And I go on campuses and tell students that, you know, women still have problems, but you do not inhabit an oppressive patriarchy if you live in the United States. And in the universities they attack America for being a capitalist, white supremacist patriarchy, and I find this unhelpful and extreme and off-putting to most people, and it's also not true.
Yeah, and it discounts all the progress that has been made over the last 50 years, over the last 100 years. I mean, they seem to want to pretend that nothing has changed since like the 1910s and the 1920s.
I just lectured at Williams College in Western Massachusetts, and a great number of students clustered in the back and furious at me for defending anything about the United States. And they actually seemed to think it was worse than any place on earth, that every problem and every human pathology originated because of Western capitalism and imperialism, and especially the United States, and then they throw the patriarchy in, and we're to blame for it all. And I just sort of politely told them, you know, you've got it backwards. We're actually, you know, very good, maybe among the best countries in the history of the world in terms of, you know, we're a very complex society. We have problems, but we're doing extremely well. Oh well, that was a heresy, and they were screaming at me.
You
can't say anything good about the United States, and it's all, this is the new feminism, it's called intersectionality, where all the oppressions intersect. So you're oppressed by your race, by your religion, you can be oppressed by your, of course, by your gender, your you know, whether or not you have a disability, and then you add them all up, and the more you have, the more oppressed you are.
There's so much,
like a score chart.
The able-bodied white heterosexual man.
There's so much value in victimhood in our society these days that, you know, it just seems like their intent and their purpose and what drives them is making sure that you find something about yourself that is being victimized and that you focus on that. Because if you feel like a victim, you're going to be looking for a champion. And that's what they want to be. They want to be the champion of all the people who are victimized. So it's really important that they make sure everybody know that they are indeed being victimized. We're talking with Christina Hoff Summers, author of The War Against Boys, coming to Minneapolis on Monday, October 30th, to deliver a speech, to deliver a presentation, Is There a War Against Men, in conjunction with our friends over at Intellectual Takeout.
Talk a bit about your book.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to ask to talk a bit about your book, The War Against Against Boys, and what brought that about, and what people can expect if they read that.
Oh, I just want to say I'm not giving a lecture. It's a kind of just a conversation.
Okay.
So I'll be talking. So in The War Against Boys, what I discovered was that boys are doing far worse than girls overall. Taken as a group, they're less likely to go to college. They're doing less well from the day they enter the classroom. The girls are better behaved. The teachers like them more. The boys get better grades, more honors, and so forth. And this is a problem worldwide. Boys have a harder time adjusting to school, but in many countries, they try to meet them halfway. Lots of recess or, you know, special kinds of things interest the average boy. We don't do that. So we're getting boys are falling further and further behind. And if you have a little boy and he's in class, as if girls are the gold standard,
mm-hmm.
boys are sort of judged as failed, you know, the girls set the standard and the boys don't meet it. And so I tried to, you know, I've written a number of books and articles around this issue to try to urge some changes in teaching methods to meet boys halfway.
Yeah.
And not to expect them to be, especially, you know, as soon as they enter school, they shouldn't be having such a negative experience.
No, we've dealt with this. I have my boys are 15, and my youngest will be 11 in December. And, you know, we're blessed that my wife, Melinda, is a stay-at-home mom, and she can provide a lot of hands-on and be really involved in their schooling. But we've dealt with this, you know, firsthand. And it's one of those things when you experience this type of thing, it's a little jarring because you're kind of, you know, as a male, and as a dad, I kind of go, is that really happening? You know, that doesn't necessarily seem right. And so, you know, if you're not aware of it, and you, it's almost like you're afraid to even bring it up or talk about it when you see it happen firsthand.
Exactly. And that's why I wrote the book. I know a lot of parents think, oh, let's just be my son. Maybe there's something wrong. No, almost all of our sons are simply... There's just no effort to assign the sorts of readings, and in the research that I did for the book, I found that what many English teachers, for example, favor is sort of books that are more for kids. You know, they're books that are more interesting to girls, and they like writers to be like the confessional writer, telling about yourself and your feelings. Well, most boys won't do that. A little boy might want to write about a monster who destroyed a city, or about you know, his skateboard or something. and let them do it. And there is harm when you discourage their interest. But worse than that, some boys are getting in trouble and suspended, you know, for playing cops and robbers in the playground. Or a little boy in Maryland bit a Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun.
Yep, remember that.
And was suspended. And we have these sorts of things. So there's just intolerance for rambunctious boyness. It's as if we've pathologized the state of being a young male.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're onto something there. Should be a fascinating conversation Monday night at the Guthrie Theater. Christina Hoff Sommers, Is There a War Against Men? I tweeted out a link for ticket information using the hashtag TCNT, and we'll also give away a pair of tickets to that event right now. Caller number 20, 651-989-5855 is going to win a pair of tickets to the Monday night event. Christina Hoff Sommers, thank you so much for your time this morning. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, take care.
Let's go right to the phones. We got a couple of people on hold, kind of keeping with the theme. We'll talk to Jared in Minneapolis. Good morning, Jared. Welcome to Twin Cities News Talk and Justice and Drew. What are your thoughts?
Hey, good morning, guys. I'm just calling to ask a couple questions on the education you know, piece you guys are just talking about. I grew up in North Minneapolis, and just listening to all these people talk about the difference of, you know, basically the black kids that are going to the same schools with kids of Asian backgrounds, of white backgrounds, and they're being left behind. I'm just trying to get that point across and clear. What is exactly you think that is happening? Because a lot of kids that I know, a lot of kids that I grew up with, a lot of kids that I know that moved on and been very, very successful from being whites, from Asians, from blacks. They had the inner city family that took care of, you know, business at home as well. They also helped out in education through, you know, athletic teams. They were at, you see them at, you know, all getting together with their families. That's the one thing that I don't see that's going on that's getting in trouble with a lot of the education piece is the people that are getting left out. Seems like at the homes, it really is a big, you know, just a big void there at the home. And I just want to know, you keep saying there's something wrong with the education system in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly are you seeing? Are you saying?
Well,
if I look at South Minneapolis, it's not that way. It's in a big hub of north side Minneapolis. Over northeast, it's a lot different. I'm just really wondering what's going on, what you're thinking on the education piece.
Yeah, if I could tell you exactly what it was, I would probably go and try to fix it. I don't know exactly what it is, but you look at the data, you look at the numbers, there is a massive achievement gap in Minneapolis public schools between minority students and white kids. And that's education is a complex and nuanced topic. There's no one fix. There's no one magic thing you can do to make it get better, but to me, a key component is giving parents more control over their kids' education, giving parents more options, more opportunities, allowing for community schools, you know, making it easier to start neighborhood schools, decentralizing the curriculum, decentralizing the control of the education of the kids in not just in Minneapolis, not just in Hennepin County, but everywhere. Decentralizing and making it more local, making it more community-based so that schools can adjust and reflect the needs of their communities better than they currently can.
And I'll add to what he was saying, because I agree with you, Drew, and to the caller. To me, it is a larger issue. It's hard to break it all down, but that home component, it's all tied in. You know, if you're in a family unit and for whatever reason the parents aren't engaged, and I won't go and cast blame right now because there are some legitimate reasons and there's a lot of not so legitimate reasons. But if you are a family that is unable and doesn't engage in your schooling with your child for whatever reason, then when they end up, they're already a step behind, mm-hmm. because when they get into school and then they're dealing with the way the school system is run, they're at a disadvantage because there's no counter to it. And that's why when we're talking with the guest, you know, we are very blessed. And I know that we are, that Melinda's able to be a stay-at-home mom, because I know what she can do and what we can do as a family to mitigate what they have to deal with on numerous levels in public school. But if there's families that can't do that and they're just left to have the school go and teach them and send them on their way, you want to know why you end up with a lot of these disparities on numerous fronts. It's a part of the reason, big reason why.
651-995-8855. We do have a couple more calls we want to take on the other side of it. And we also are going to be joined by Katie Pavlich here in about 15 minutes or so. And your chance to win a grand. The keyword's coming up in just a couple of moments.
Yeah, we'll also find out how apparently white privilege is bolstered by teaching math.
What?
Yeah, math is racist.
Well, I never liked math anyway. Justice in...
Win a pair of tickets to Culture in the Columns Music Series at James J. Hill Center featuring the Sean Johnson Big Band. Experience. Register today at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
You can register to win that. You can register to win your Acme party at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com for up to 25 people for your holiday party. It's an amazing prize. And as if that weren't enough,
we have so many giveaways.
Doing all the giveaways right now. John, you want to do it right now?
Sure.
651-989-5855 is the phone number. Caller number 20 is going to win a pair of tickets to the Dead End Hayride. Not just tickets, VIP tickets to the Dead End Hayride. You can use them anytime. However, if you're so inclined, you could join us tomorrow night.
Yeah, and it's really cool if you come and hang with us. We're going to be there right around 7:30.
Yeah.
And then we're going to be heading in right around 7:45. And it's kind of a bonus if you hang with us at the Dead End Hayride tomorrow, because not only do you get to get terrified because of all the terrors on the Dead End Hayride, but you also get the added bonus of seeing Sam terrified,
right,
because of all the terrors at the Dead End Hayride.
And you'll be the first to know what she hit on the way there.
True story. Who knows what they will hit on the hayride? Who knows what that'll get? What'll get run over?
I got a really nasty look.
Did you really? Way to go. That was all you.
Well, who knows? You know,
minus Paul.
Stay out of her way.
That's between y'all.
Maybe Sam can carpool with somebody.
We are going to tell you how math is racist in just a moment. First off, though, let's go and talk with Rick. Good morning, Rick. Welcome to Justice and Drew.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Good topic today, guys. I just wanted to call in and say that on that subject, I had a son in high school in the South Metro here. And man, my kid, I'm not blowing my own horn, but he was sharp, good, you know, normal kid, could think. But the public schools failed him, and this is how. He was a boy, like that woman you guessed you had on. It's like a war against these kids. He had to sit in classes. It was like going to prison for him. They had 80-minute classes, and sometimes, and twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon, they'd have them back-to-back, and they would have 5-minute breaks between those classes, and my kid just could not do it. He'd get done with his work, and they'd force him to sit there for 60 minutes 4 times a day. You know what? He quit school in the 11th grade because he said, Dad, I hate it. I can't go there anymore.
Yeah.
So So that's your public school system right there. I just wanted to make that comment.
How's he doing now?
He's construction, of course, you know.
Good. He's doing all right, then. That's the thing. You know,
he's doing all right. I mean, he'll survive, but, you know, what a waste of a brain. And I'm I know he's not the only child. I mean, many people's sons are. They can't sit there that long. Then they get in trouble because they start snickering with their buddies. And it's just a crying shame because, you know, let them have. I talked to somebody about that, and they don't even have classes that long in college.
Yeah.
It's retarded.
Well, when you think about, and just for a moment, think about all of the relevant data about time we spend in the workplace and our attention spans and what we know about the youth today and time management and all these things that get applied at the corporate level. That get applied to jobs. When you look at the way that we can, and that's not to say that that every school does it wrong, but it is to say that when you look at how we should be revamping the education system, even on a time management level, like almost reevaluating year after year after year. You see little tiny steps, like when the kids in high school will be able to have a slightly later start time. But when you think about the relevant data about how the youth is today, how children are today, how they spend their time, what their attention spans are, we have enough data where you could completely upend the education system to make it way more effective than what it is right now, and you will never see that happen apart from those little tiny inches that you get of like pushing things a half hour or an hour. Yeah, it won't happen.
Yeah, they'll tinker around the edges of reform and act like it's a big deal. But you want to talk about the opportunities that we have of true massive educational reform in this country with the availability of technology, the internet, what they could learn at home and what they actually need to be sort of in the classroom or at the school for. I mean, you know, you could get very creative and you could have certain subjects be taught via the internet, via YouTube videos, via PDFs or PowerPoints, things like that, things they can do at home over the internet, and then some things that they can do at school. That would be, you know, groundbreaking, you know, paradigm shifting type reforms that the teachers union will never even consider, because the teachers union has a stranglehold on the education systems in Minneapolis and all over the country, really, but specifically in Minneapolis and Minnesota. And their number one priority is not your kids' education, not the quality of your kids' education. No, it's to keep their jobs, to keep their teachers, to keep those union dues flowing in so that they can use them to elect more politicians that are going to do more to direct more funds their way.
Well, out of Fox News, maybe Rochelle Gutierrez, a math education professor with the University of Illinois, will be the one to save it all. She has laid out some views on a particular issue as the subject of an article for a newly published anthology for math educators titled Building Support for Scholarly Practices in Mathematic Methods. And what she says here is that the ability to solve geometry and algebra problems in teaching such subjects perpetuates so-called white privilege.
Huh?
Math is racist, what? Drew, is what we're saying.
I knew I hated math.
School.
I never knew why.
But
I knew I did.
She says, okay, school mathematics curricula, emphasizing terms like the Pythagorean theorem and pi, perpetuate a perception that mathematics was largely developed by Greeks and other Europeans. She also says that addressing equity in mathematics education will come when teachers can understand and negotiate the politics outside the classroom. On many levels, mathematics itself operates as whiteness.
No! No, it doesn't.
Who are you to say, white man? Who gets credit for doing and developing mathematics? And who is capable of mathematics? And who is seen as part of the mathematical community is generally viewed as white. What's really not interesting, but this is actually...
This is probably the last area of public education that they haven't racialized. And now they're like, all right, we got everything else.
Well, it's been going on...
Time to get math.
It's been going on for a while. I've seen this happen in other districts where it's been brought up. Fortunately, in those circumstances, it was immediately smacked down as being stupid because it is stupid. But now... You know, you look, and that was about 5 or 6 years ago when I saw that pop up in a different school district. Now you have a climate that's more conducive to having this get attention. Gutierrez says evaluations of math skills can perpetuate discrimination against minorities, especially if they do worse than their white counterparts. If one is not viewed as mathematical, there will always be a sense of inferiority that can be summoned. Okay, stop. Hold on real quick. I'm real white. Mm-hmm. I was awful at math. Mm-hmm. I was horrible. You know what? I was horrible. I was horrible at math. And I believe that it was because it was racialized. It was against me. It was numberists. It was numberist against me. According to the website, Gutierrez adds that there are so many people who have experienced microaggressions from participating in math classrooms.
No, there haven't.
Where people are judged by whether they can reason abstractly.
No, that didn't happen. None of that happened. You're making that up. That's a lie.
So what about all the other kids that do bad in other courses? Right? I mean, can you go and contextualize that in a racial manner as well? Which is kind of the joke that I was attempting to make that I failed miserably on. But can you contextualize any student that, you know, what if he's in social studies? Right? What if it's, you know, it's a home ec?
Yeah.
Shop!
Is home ec even a thing?
I don't know. I told you how long it's been since I've been to school. World history! What if you fail in world history? Right? You know, get all that. Because it's not right to go and contextualize one based off of, well, if one kid is this color and he doesn't do as well as another kid who is white, then obviously it's racism unless you're going to go and look at all of them that way.
Right. And look, some people are good at math. Some people aren't. Math is cut out. Some people are cut out. They've got the mind for math and some people don't. It's got nothing to do with race at all. And this idea that emphasizing a term like the Pythagorean theorem, do they realize that's named after the person who like discovered it?
Pags?
Joe Pags. It's the Joe Pythagorean theorem, yeah.
Oh, that's a good idea for him, though. The Joe Pags' theorem.
So if something is named after somebody and that person happens to be white or of some sort of European descent, do we have to call it something else? So as not to emphasize their whiteness or their European descent?
Well, let's drive at the heart of what is actually, you know, happening here. And when you look at the reason why she goes and perpetuates something like this is that they don't want to go and look at the real root causes. And it spins right back around to the discussion that we were having just a moment ago.
Yeah.
It spins right back around to they don't want to point to the poor education system. They don't want to dare go and point at the fact that maybe families are not as engaged with their kids in what is happening. They'd rather go and try to find something else to go and blame for these test scores. And it's way easier to go and play the simple race card than it is to go and point out about the real problems that we have in education. That's probably what is really causing the biggest problem when it comes to these issues.
This article didn't go into it, but I'm curious how you teach math. I mean, because math is just logic. There's nothing but logic when it comes to math. There's no context. There's no societal context you can put it in. How do you teach math to make it less white privileged?
Unless you go and you make it racist. I mean, that's the only way.
Yeah, you have to add.
You have to add the racial component.
Social component to it.
Right. Which is awful. Which would be horrible to do.
Which is a really bad idea.
It's a bad idea. Really. Like, I don't want anyone to talk about it because it's a really bad idea. 651-989-5855. All right. We're going to be joined by Katie Pavlich from Fox News. We have lots to get to with Katie. We'll get into the investigation into the DOJ's exoneration of Hillary Clinton that came out earlier this week. We, of course, have the Uranium One issue. We have the fake dossier and the Clinton campaign and the DNC that perpetuated the fake dossier. Plus, we have that informant that apparently now will be able to go and speak to Congress to expose more of what's happening with Uranium One. On top of all that, we will give, and we'll get Katie's thoughts on this, a bit of the details of this in Boston, this progressive fair wage pizza shop that had to, they had a novel idea,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Open up a pizza shop based on the principles of economic justice and fair wages to support the community. Would you like to know, as a preview, Drew, would you like to know what it was named? It's a pizza shop.
Yeah.
Dudley Dough. I think that's their first problem.
Should have gone with everybody gets a slice of the pie.
That's really
it's much better.
That's really great. That was really good. Katie Pavlich next.
Justice in.
Hey, Hey, this weekend, big news. If you haven't already downloaded the iHeartRadio app, if you're using any other sort of music streaming app or service or anything like that, do yourself a favor. Download the iHeartRadio app, because this weekend they're doing a free preview of unlocking all of the paid benefits, all of the subscription benefits that you can get over the course of the weekend. So you're going to be able to see everything that the iHeartRadio app is capable of. And I am confident, because I know I do, I've reached this conclusion. If you compare and contrast it with whatever you're currently using, I don't care if it's Spotify, Pandora, Apple Music, whatever, you compare and contrast the benefits of the iHeartRadio app and the functionality of the iHeartRadio app against all those, iHeartRadio will come out the superior brand or the superior app every single time.
Yeah, and I can attest to that, because I used to use the Apple Music, and I don't anymore. I use everything that the iHeartRadio app has to offer. And if you've downloaded it already, you know it's free. You can already access the Justice and Drew channel, listen to our podcast there. But this weekend, everything that it has to offer, unlimited skips, these amazing curated playlist. You can make your own playlist. You can download your own music to your phone. Listen offline. It'll all be available all weekend long. So be sure you take advantage of this. This is a fantastic opportunity. A nice little Halloween gift for you.
Yeah, it's really cool. And you mentioned it. It's one of my favorite things about it is that fact that you never have to leave the app. You want to switch from your custom music station or your favorite radio station that have thousands across the country to a podcast. You do it all right there.
Fox News contributor and editor at townhall.com, lover of boots, and your list goes, I just kind of pick the ones that I always talk about. Katie Pavlich.
Always the most important, so you got that down.
All right, so in just a moment, Katie, we're going to let you choose your own adventure, so can get excited about that. Okay.
Turn to page 77.
Yeah, shake it down. We got a list of items here, so we're going to let you choose which one you want to tackle.
Nice.
First off, though, this comes out of Boston, and we thought we've been talking about it, haven't had a chance to cover it yet, and figure you'll get a kick out of this if you haven't heard about it already. But in the Roxbury neighborhood of Boston, back in 2015. This comes out of Hot Air. Says the people at the nonprofit organization Haley House, Katie, they came up with a novel idea. They would open up a pizza shop based on the principles of economic justice and fair wages to support the community. It was called Dudley Dough, right? The shop would pay wages far above minimum, which many people in that industry earn, with added incentives for training and community development. It was an inspiring idea. Unfortunately, 2 years later, it's closing down.
Wow. You mean economics don't match up with the emotional, strategery of the left?
Right.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it turns out that operating a for-profit business on the principles of a nonprofit social justice operation results in an undesirable side effect. They were literally not producing a profit.
Yeah, well, if liberal Boston really cares about those principles, they would be donating money to save the pizza shop, but apparently that's not happening either.
True story right there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, Back to the Future, save the clock tower, but instead, save Dudley Dough.
$50 for a slice of pizza to make these people have a living wage.
Yep, this is not the only restaurant that's made this sort of calculation or taken this risk. It's happened here. You've seen it not just with living wages, but you've seen it with the tipping, non-tipping that, they're marketing themselves is saying, look, we're going to do this thing and we're going to do it a little differently. And the crowd that clamors the loudest for government to force all these businesses to do this, they don't show up and support the businesses that do.
Nope.
Well, and the thing is, back to this idea that these jobs are not supposed to be a career, right? They're supposed to be great entry-level jobs for people to start their life out either in high school or college.
Or a second job.
Build on that. Right.
Yeah.
Or a second job or whatever. It's not meant to be a long-term career choice. So,
but Katie, if you work 40 hours a week, you should make as much money as you need. And you get to determine how much that is.
I just have a hard time thinking that we should be paying people flipping burgers, which there's nothing wrong with, obviously, but more than we pay our military, for example. It just doesn't really make a lot of sense.
But Katie, you don't believe that if you work 40 hours a week, you should be able to have a wage that supports your addiction to boots?
Well, technically, I think I would be okay with that if we put that on the ballot. I think we could run a national campaign on that, but that's an exception.
Well, And one more real, just one more real quick point on this whole thing is that that's what's so unfortunate about when you look at the fight for 15, these minimum wage pushes is that what they could be doing is really trying to prepare people for these new jobs. When you look at Amazon wanting to have a new headquarters with 50,000 positions open, these are potential careers where there is some growth in a number of different areas, and they could really be pushing people to go that route, you know, because the route of the food industry and service is going to be going the way of automation, and they're not doing that. It's so disingenuous.
Well, one of the companies that does a really good job of getting people in the door and then boosting their careers is Walmart. There are plenty of people who started out as cashiers at Walmart. They become managers, and then they become store managers with multiple stores and make six figures a year. So that's a good example of how, you know, you don't have to stay stuck in the entry-level job. You can actually work your way up and make something of yourself. But they want to get people stuck at the $15 an hour threshold, which doesn't pull out people out of poverty at all. It just keeps people in a mediocre state for the rest of their lives.
All right, Katie, time to choose your own adventure. I got a number of different headlines here. One of them actually here from one of your articles earlier this week, but you can choose which one is top of your list and whatever other ones we get to. So you've got the open investigation into the Department of Justice exoneration of Hillary Clinton. You've got the holder on the withholding of IRS settlement payments to conservative groups. That came out this week. You have the FEC complaint accusing Clinton campaign and DNC of violating the campaign finance law with the dossier payments. Oh, and you have the FBI informant who is now clear and free to face a congressional hearing over what he may have learned in regards to nuclear bribes with Russia and Uranium One, where he was undercover. So, Katie, choose your own adventure. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with the Oversight Committee and the Intelligence Committee in the House reopening their investigation into, not reopening, but opening an investigation into the exoneration of Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
The reason I find that interesting is because when new administrations come in, typically they move on and the corruption of the past is left to be, and there isn't a lot of accountability for what happened. But I think that Trey Gowdy deserves a lot of credit for trying to make sure that, you know, just because you're in government or have the last name Clinton doesn't mean that you are above the law. And I also think it's good to take a look at what the FBI has been doing. Why is it that they wrote and drafted a letter exonerating Hillary Clinton 2 months before she had even been interviewed? Because it's a crisis of confidence in our institutions, right? So if you ask Americans, they will say that they don't believe that our institutions are functioning properly. And if the Justice Department is in that category, it's a problem. So I like the idea that they're cleaning things up.
Does in terms of accountability, do you see a better chance? Because I think, I mean, you're right. I mean, for a lot of us, and including myself, I don't expect anybody, or I haven't up until maybe perhaps right now, expect anybody to be held accountable when it comes to this investigation and what Comey did in these exonerations prior to when he even conducted the interviews. But when it comes to accountability, do you see a better chance of Hillary Clinton, if there was wrongdoing, being held accountable, or Comey being held accountable before the dossier and the Clinton campaign and the DNC?
Here's the thing. Even though Hillary Clinton was exonerated criminally and she, you know, isn't in prison, she was held accountable by the American people by losing on Election Day.
Right.
And that means something, right? It really does. You know, it's frustrating that people like her get a free pass, even though, you know, people who have done the same exact thing as she did, or far less, were severely punished for it, and their lives were ruined and turned upside down as a result. But, you know, she is suffering the consequences of her corruption and her lying, and it's only coming back to bite her further as we get into this Uranium One scandal, as the FBI informant comes forward. And, by the way, now that we know that she paid for this Russian dossier, it opens the door to a whole bunch of questions about who the campaign was working with. I have, you know, suspicions that meeting that they set that was set up at Trump Tower with Don Jr. Remember that?
Right.
I have a feeling that Democrats set that meeting up, especially considering the lawyer couldn't get into the U.S. and the Justice Department then gave her a special visa to get in, and then she went and had this meeting. So we're at the tip of the iceberg, as they like to say. And, you know, people will argue, well, you have to move on beyond Hillary Clinton. Why are you still talking about her? Well, Well, as long as Hillary Clinton is going to be out in the debate,
right,
accusing Republicans of certain things and talking about what happened and saying she's not going away, then we absolutely get to talk about her.
And, well, beyond that, Katie, as long as there's this continuing belief among certain sectors that the Trump administration colluded with Russia to tip the election their way, Hillary Clinton is a relevant part of that conversation, especially with what we know now.
Well, and especially when you have White House press corps, you know, quote, journalists asking questions inside the press briefing by citing Hillary Clinton.
Right.
As if she has any relevance at all to the decisions that the White House is making. So when they argue, well, now it's time to move on.
They're with her.
We don't want to talk about this anymore. She's the one who's still inserting herself into the debate. So if you don't want to talk about her, give her a phone call and tell her to shut up.
Well, and I'm glad that you brought that, because it is sort of the rules of engagement. I remember when former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was going through her time of recovery after that horrible shooting that took place on January 8th. And I felt much the same way. It's like, okay, look, she has every right to stay out of all of this, right? To just go with her husband and just have a regular life and recuperate. Doesn't owe anybody anything. But she didn't do that. She decided to go and put herself out there in the spotlight, push for these gun reforms. And it's to me a lot along the same lines. You continue to perpetuate, you continue to make these arguments, and you're going to have to deal with the repercussions and the blowback on that.
This is a massive scandal, and I don't think that most people out there really fully appreciate how big a scandal this is. They're now brushing it off as it's opposition research. Everybody does opposition research.
It's insane. The 20% uranium thing, working with corrupt Russian officials who were sent by Vladimir Putin, and Hillary approved it, and then Bill Clinton got a whole bunch of personal money for speaking fees, and the Clinton Foundation got $145 million. I mean, that is insane. And if they're going to accuse the Trump campaign of collusion, it's like they were cozier with the Russians than anybody could have been.
Yeah.
They're just accusing them of what they've been doing.
They used opposition research to trigger an FBI investigation. And let's not forget the context of what was going on in the election when this was happening. One of the narratives that was commonly heard out there regarding Hillary Clinton was, do we really want to elect a president who's under investigation by the FBI? So apparently their response to that was, well, let's just trigger an FBI investigation on Trump. And then that takes that away. It takes that argument away. It takes that attack away.
Well, and there's been no evidence at all, except for the one email of Don Jr. accepting that meeting, which I think now was set up by the Clinton campaign,
right,
or people close to it. And yet that's been the narrative. And of course, now that there's evidence of the Clinton campaign and Clinton herself working with the Russian government directly to line her own pockets, the media is ignoring it. It's like, I will give the Washington Post they're the ones who came out with the dossier story.
Right.
However, that was a result of Devin Nunes, who's the House Intelligence Committee chairman, subpoenaing the campaign. That came through a subpoena. But all of the networks are ignoring it. As if Russia's not an issue.
Are you hearing, what is your opinion of what potentially this FBI informant who previously, up until last night, who was undercover during this time, was unable to go and give his testimony. Now he will be able to. What is the expectation to hear? Does anybody know yet?
Well, I know that we're not going to find out who he is for his own protection. Or at least, I hope that he won't.
I hope he's under federal protection right now.
Right.
Right. He's under federal protection for two reasons: A, the Clintons, and B, the Russians. So, when you have Vladimir Putin and the Clintons on your back, you need to make sure that people know who you are.
That is terrifying. I'd rather have Freddy Krueger and Jason chasing me.
Yeah. So this guy must have some good stuff if that's what he's willing to risk. That's all I have to say. He's probably got some good stuff.
How soon do we have any idea of how soon these are? Because I want to definitely watch and I want to have popcorn. Any idea on how soon that these hearings might end up taking place?
I would think almost immediately. I would say next week even.
Yeah.
It'll be behind closed doors, but I would say that they probably want to get them done as soon as possible.
Dovetailing back to the Gowdy opening the investigation on the DOJ's exoneration of Hillary Clinton, which was the first adventure that you chose. Now, moving forward on that, just to kind of bring it back around, what is your expectation on this? Further light being shown on what took place, or accountability beyond what we talked about of her obviously, you know, losing the election?
I think the overall goal isn't necessarily political for Trey Gowdy. If you look at the statement, it's all about restoring faith in the institution of the Justice Department and the FBI. He's a man of the law. He believes in blind justice, wholly. And I think his main goal is to bring back some accountability to the FBI and to take the politics out of it and make sure that they are conducting investigations, whether it's into a Republican or a Democrat, in a fair, unbiased way. Because clearly there was something going on last year in that sense. So we'll see what the results of his investigation find. But I think he's really trying to restore some kind of faith in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is probably pretty important.
Two things before we let you go. One, are you going to be on TV anytime soon? And two, will you be labeled as Juan Williams?
Geraldo or Juan tomorrow.
That was really funny.
Outnumbered, and I'm not sure who I will be, but I'm really excited though because Kevin Sorbo is going to be on, and this brings me back to my childhood because we didn't have TV, and so the only thing that was ever on the three channels we could get was Hercules and Dina. And weird jokes.
No Quantum Leap.
No, what? No.
That's where I thought
Quantum
she was.
Quantum Leap's more R.
I was going to be shocked if she played the Quantum Leap card.
Yeah.
Sam's looking at his cross-eyed. She has no idea what we're talking about. But they mislabeled her on the screen. She was. Well, it was really kind of funny. So it made me laugh.
Katie Pavlich, always a pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Look forward to catching up with you next week.
Got the roundtable coming in tomorrow. We've got a smattering, but it's more like a plethora of stories.
Right.
That we have not
haven't had a chance to get to
and kind of been holding on to for tomorrow's show, along with the plethora of prizes that we have to give away, too.
We are going
to
give away more Dead End Hayride tickets. Keep using that hashtag Tim Hortons TCNT. We're going to give away Acme Comedy Company tickets with Brian Miller in the 8 o'clock hour. Also, Tom Emmer is going to join us tomorrow at 7 o'clock.
Awesome.
Should be a very fun show. Nick Zerwas, Brian Miller, Tom Emmer, lots of prizes. Keep using that hashtag, Tim Hortons TCNT.
Have yourself a fantastic Thursday.
I debunked that.
And don't hit any deer.
Yeah. You need an escort on the way home?
They're not all Sam. They should be fine.
Oh, okay.
I'm Chris Addison. Here's a look.